They just didn't mind working 12-hour days at all. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. You didn't resent it?
Not at all. Mm-hmm. No, never knew that there was such a thing as resentment.
Nobody brought that subject up, right? Do you think that contributed to your feeling for the land?
Yes, it is, really, because I worked with it one way or the other most of my life.
Could you give any more specific details about that?
Well, I remember my uncle could see deer moving out into the edge of the harvest field in the evening to forage, and everything come to a stop, and out came the rifle, and he hung up his winter supply of venison, and that's what everybody did. They were living off the land one way or the other.
I was wondering specifically how the harvesting process might have contributed to your feeling for the land.
You watched everything grow, and you watched everything come to a satisfactory harvest or a lack of harvest, and you skimped when...
The effects of the weather.
All of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, of course, hardly anybody understood soil chemistry or what makes soil productive. We abused soil pretty bad. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'd like now, to be knowledgeable and also to be in a position to direct how soil is to be taken care of.
There were no extension agents around at that time?
Not
And nobody had been to college to study agriculture?
They had not, that's right.
They just winged it and did what they thought would be the natural thing to do.
Did just that. And erosion was rampant, and for people that tilled the soil, that was just... nothing could be done about it. Never even thought there could be.
And the tilling was all done with horse and plow, I suppose.
It was, definitely.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I suppose they didn't know anything about crop rotation.
Not whatsoever.
Why do you think they selected the crops they did? You said oats, for instance.
There was... railroads did help about then to get established where you could market your stock. And I can remember grandparents shipping hogs to Salt Lake and also the Portland market, and by train, and then, of course, livestock also. And I can remember in the little town of Stanfield, nearly every railroad had siding, and, of course, the livestock cars would set on sidings for most of the year until fall, when they usually went to market. And they were, they had that much room between the slats, so you knew what was a livestock car, but you can't find one nowadays. They haven't used them for 30 years.
When you were young and living in the Wallowa Valley, do you remember any times when you just stood and looked at the snow-capped mountains and the configuration of the valley and thought to yourself anything about its beauty?
That came about only after I had climbed them all. I climbed Mount Hood when I was 13 years old, and Mount Adams, Mount Thielson.
You mean you had to get up higher in order to appreciate the beauty?
Because you could see, you could see all of the mountain. Mm-hmm.
What do you remember thinking when you saw those views?
Well, I didn't hear the expression when people would say, why do you climb mountains? And I was probably 20 before I learned it, to see what's on the other side of the mountain.
But or because it's there.
What?
Or because they're there.
Because they're there. Those two expressions are pretty dumb. Yeah. And there isn't really very many mountains that I haven't been on top of.
So do you think those climbing experiences and taking in the views had a lasting effect on you?
A real lasting effect, yeah. When I got out of the Navy, 5 years after I climbed Mount Hood, we picked cherries and we were called fruit tramps in the Dalles, Hood River, come here to eastern Oregon, prunes in Milton Freewater, so that was 3 months of summer that to buy my school clothes. But I just said, let's go, we finished picking cherries today, let's go climb Mount Hood tomorrow. And 23 people went with me, family and friends, and so I've always enjoyed getting other people involved in the outdoors.
So there were social occasions?
Very much a social occasion.
Even so, what do you think was your sense of wilderness? I mean, wilderness can be enjoyed with a group of other people, but it can also be enjoyed when you're alone. For you, was it a toss-up?
I've never really ever done very much of that by myself. I always felt like it was a waste of time not to have lots of other people in with me. So I've even owned 17 horses and mules so that I could take senator and representative aides to show them what we want protected. And of course, 90% of this was all wilderness when I came to Oregon in 1926. And it was just alarming to see how quickly it was not becoming wilderness. Just like that picture right there, every inch of that picture belongs in wilderness, and yet it isn't, and it isn't protected.
Well, at what point in your life, especially if you're having social climbing experiences, did you get the sense that wilderness needed to be protected?
It did take visual people like Rick and hundreds of other Sierra Clubbers and Isaac Walton. I was president of our Northwest Isaac Walton League for several years, that we all started talking about it, and then we all supported each other. And there used to only be maybe three prominent known conservation organizations 30 years ago, and now we have literally dozens of them.
Because, well, let's go back, if we could, to whatever experiences you can recall that triggered in your mind the realization that wilderness was being lost or that it needed protection.
When I came to La Grande from Oregon Tech and Klamath Falls, climbed all those mountains around that area, came here, and we had an organization that the Isaac Walton League had sponsored called Save the Minim. It was a 43-mile river out here on the other side of the Wallowa Union County boundary that went up the neatest canyon, and there, the supervisor had given the survey crews direction to go stake the canyon for a 23-mile road. That was half of the canyon. And it was a real pork barreler. There was, it already had been river logged, meaning they had splash dams, logs, floated the logs to the mill. That's what they did all over the Northwest. Well, that had already been done, so there wasn't really any timber value. It was just to waste money and ruin the real future of the canyon.
Why do you say waste money?
It would have been a total pork barrel. Every foot of dirt that would have been moved for a road was only going to hinder the water quality of the river.
Well, what was the purpose of the road?
They never did say. We brought it to their attention and was able to convince Senator Hatfield and Representative Al Ullman that that what the value of the canyon was by taking him there, showing him what was there, and showing him what shouldn't be there is that road. And they both recognized that the road didn't need to be built, and they sponsored our legislation, and that was 50 years ago.
But could the road have been used for logging trucks?
Sure, it could have, and they would have scratched up the little draws that go up away from the river that was beyond horse logging. You're right. It was only horses pulling them in to the edge of the river and then having the river raise enough to take them on down to the mill, which was 28 miles away.
And you said it was the U.S. government that was building the road?
Yes.
The Forest Service?
Yes.
And you never saw anything written in Forest Service documents that would specify why they were putting the road in?
They do the surveys and do this, and then they go to the Department of Agriculture and say, we'd like to have you budget money for this kind of road, this kind of development, and that's what they're still doing.
And why do you say it was pork barrel?
Because it was wasting money that could be better spent somewhere else.
Who would benefit from it?
The other things? Oh,
directly.
No, Boise Cascade came to LeGrand in 1950, and they came here to promote any road they can get, and they're...
So it must have been for logging purposes.
We have 10,000 miles on the Wallowa-Whitman National Forest of roads, and most of them have been built in the last 50 years, and 6,000 miles of those 10,000 are on right here around Boise Cascade, right where they can use public resources and only pay for a small fraction of the cost.
And was clear cutting the rule then?
Whenever they thought that old decadent forest had no place in forestry is when they decided that we'll clear cut, and the animals and wildlife that depended on old growth, there was nothing considered for that at all. In fact, even we conservationists really didn't know that there were half of our wildlife and species were dependent on old growth.
Now, the word ecology, it was known to some people at that time, but did you hear anybody use that word?
Not till recently.
From a conservation standpoint, you know, the thing that's interesting to me is back, you know, when you were 6-7 years old and working the fields, and the deer would come in the fields at night, and everybody would, you know, you didn't go to the grocery store. You know, you hunted and grew your own or whatever. So at what point did you recognize, or who taught you to recognize, that you can't just go out there and keep shooting deer, that there has to be management controls and that the habitat has to be protected?
It came about fairly easy because elk were almost eliminated in the Blue Mountains. 1933, to get the public's attention and educating the public and educating us, Billy Meadows out in the right in the edge of the National Recreation Area right we put up a big fence out there. We had these stock train cars from the railroad, went to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and brought 50 to 70 elk here and out, and then we put them in horse-drawn stock wagons that they couldn't jump out of, and put them inside of a fence for 12 years, and then we opened the gates and let the animals out. We gave the public the opinion that there was they were on the verge of extinction, but the state game warden estimated there were 2,000 elk still distributed through the ruggedest parts of the Blue Mountains, and no one wanted to work that hard to go harvest them, so that was a little buffer. But then we had a season for maybe 25 elk, and had a season, and naturally there were big, big trophy animals. Well, that gave the public and the law enforcement people were enough of them hired to prevent ranchers that had been harvesting them for five generations of family have lived off from wild animals. And that got us pretty well educated to do the same with other wildlife.
So it was your direct observations of elk depletion that made you aware that there was something bad
that's
going on here?
That's the way to put
The frontier mentality where, you know, the attitude that we're never going to run out and we just go out and do
right.
what we want. So that wasn't so pervasive back then. That frontier mentality, there was a lot of people that recognized that we could run out.
They did.
Elk or trees or whatever. That's interesting.
Were there a lot of people or just a few people then that realized it?
There were a lot of people.
Hunters?
And hunters, naturally, because they set out
12
years of no elk hunting.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
That was a good point.
Okay. Did you continue to be a hunter yourself?
Oh, there was nobody that was better at hunting than I was, really.
What was your attitude toward it? Why did you do it?
Well, in Colorado, we'd go visit where I came from. Eastern Colorado had millions of rabbits, and all my families had greyhound dogs. A Sunday after church was to take the stock wagon. Everybody, every rancher who'd come in from 20 miles with their dogs, we would drive these rabbits into, because they were eating the crops that you were raising, and we'd kill maybe 500, 600 rabbits by running them in, load them onto the hay wagons, go feed them to the pigs. You kind of did two or three things at once by doing that. Eastern Oriental, by Hermiston, where I lived, we had lots of rabbits. They ate the alfalfa fields. There was an abundance of them. And now, really, between here and the Nevada border, you'll maybe see one rabbit run over in the road. There used to be 100 would be run over. So there, the blacktail and the whitetail rabbit are almost extinct now. But it made us realize that it was a balance. But now we're going back to an imbalance. We've kind of overdone doing in. But we hear of rabbits are unique about every 7 years. If there's enough population, they build up again. In southeastern Idaho, about every 7 years, you'll hear of them having an epidemic of black-tailed rabbits.
Well, I think I detect some contradictions here.
Okay.
Maybe you could explain your present attitude toward the role of humans in maintaining the balance of forces of nature.
We're fortunate to have a fair ratio of educated animal husbandry people that and wildlife. People didn't used to be able to speak up at a public meeting and give direction on what would be best for management because they were laughed out of the meeting room. But now they're able not only to stand up and give scientific information on wildlife management, and they ask and they get more consideration. But not nearly enough.
Well, do you agree then that the ways in which humans impact the environment are sometimes good?
I can't think of very many times.
Well, killing all the rabbits.
In the whole
That, but you think
you can do that with the Chinese pheasant? We used to have thousands of them, and used to have lots and lots of this animal and this animal, and they are all on. Most of them are on a downgrade.
The way you talked about shooting rabbits because they were eating the grain made it sound to me as though you approved of that.
It proved to be adequate for 40 years. I watched an adequate population was never in danger until there's an endemic level of all animals. My brother-in-law was head of the Game Commission here in this corner of Oregon, so I was fortunate to hear and have questions answered that I had from his education at Oregon State. And so we introduced the chukar from India, which is a great upland bird, but we had 25 times more than what the land would bear, and pretty soon they crashed. And asking why, and he says they reached the endemic level and they had natural parasites and diseases that level them off. And most of the animals, nature does that.
Yeah.
Automatically.
That's what I was thinking. There are natural means
for
maintaining a balance.
There are.
But as soon as you introduce humans, you disrupt the natural means.
It's just exactly.
And I thought I was hearing you say that, well, that's inevitable. Humans are going to do that anyway. Is that what you think?
Well, that's what they did do.
Well,
and but we conservationists, we really felt like we should be able to cease doing these extremes by man's activity.
So you wouldn't prohibit wilderness areas from any kind of human intervention, right?
As long as it is in balance with the vegetation and the animals that are there. But, you know, a lynx, we haven't seen a lynx in this part of the country.
Uh-huh. Have you come to the conclusion then that it's only through science that we'll be able to figure out how to maintain the balance?
We've had lots of science. LeGrand is kind of the capital of forestry science. We've had a wildlife lab that produced the chief of the Forest Service. We've been right here where we're able to be around 30 or 40 of these people over the last 40 years. So we know that science, but we have land managers and private landowners that doesn't accept very little of this science. They like it as long as we stay in our cubicles and not come out with voodoo type of science, they call it.
What do you say when they confront you with this idea? I suppose you talk to the people who have these attitudes, don't you?
All the time.
Okay, well, what do you usually say to them? Could you give me a sense of how the conversation goes?
It's pretty hard because they don't give you a chance to say anything very often. But I did serve in 1972 the first Oregon Forest Practices Act, which was really the first in the world. Well, who were on the committees? Weyerhaeuser, Boise Cascade, every corporate leader, there were six of them, and just one of me. So, and then when you only get your input in on 2% of the time, it's always that way.
Mm-hmm.
And right now there's great big land area conglomerates that have gotten funded to do forest thinning, fire suppression, make forest less fire prone. And all of it's against science. Every bit of it's against science. It's against wildlife. I know what I had to do to get an elk in a lodgepole thicket. And it was an all-day contest between him and I. Now, there isn't even a lodgepole thicket. They want to even thin the new regeneration and all it, and they say it's for fire suppression, but what it really is getting a pellet factory. In last week's paper said they'd like to come to our area and make stove pellets out of what they call waste laying on the floor. Well, nature has to have that waste to make the soil recycle into quality vegetation, whether it's grass, forbs, shrubs, trees.
Now, I suppose you don't consider these people inherently evil. They're just overwhelmed by economic and political necessities. Is that right?
I put in the truth is that they're 90% evil, and the other 10% they are satisfied.
Well, don't you think that's a harsh judgment?
I'm too old to think less than that.
Well, what about the Forest Service, Lauren? I mean, we the problems that we have with them today. They don't tell us the truth, and they don't want to protect the land, and they don't even want to obey the laws that require them to protect the land. Was it always like that? Or was there good people here at one time in the Forest Service?
I have worked for lots of rangers. When I was in high school, when I got out of the Navy, I lived in Troy and redesigned the ridge road from toll gate all the way to Troy. And every ranger I've known all my life in Eastern Oregon, and they are uncanny in giving you a feeling that they're managing the land the best way they can. But when they really go out on the ground and see what's happened in my 75 years, they aren't hired unless as rangers or supervisors unless they are a little bit unreliable. In they're just always been there to satisfy the stockholder of corporations.
They're in the corporate pocket.
They're in the corporate pocket.
And you say they wouldn't keep their jobs unless they were?
They would not. We've had rangers. One year we had a tussock moth outbreak, and he had worked for EPA. He decided to change and go transfer into the Forest Service. Right up there on the top of that ridge was solid brown. And in fact, he called the sale of brown sugar. We put DDT on every inch of the Umatilla Forest. In wildernesses, didn't make any difference. Vast roadless areas. And he went right over to the helicopter the morning he was to go up and spray DDT on the top of that ridge and called it off. He immediately was transferred to a lesser job in the back shelves of the Melhere National Forest in John Day. And he was transferred around to different areas, but he never had a future. Never ever got back a ranger responsibility. They know how to, and I was in the Navy, watched the same thing happen to advancement within the ranks of a military organization, and it was the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, when it comes to trying to get these people in the Forest Service, and I suppose in political positions, to pay attention to what science is saying about maintaining natural balance, is it primarily a matter of they're just not wanting to hear that message, or they won't take the time to study it, or something else?
Last Friday, when we left to leave here to go to Portland for Rick's, our HCPC meeting, here was a neat little pamphlet in a brown envelope that we'd get two or three of every week, and it was for three national forests, the Melhere, the Lyell-Whitman, the Umatilla, on resource management. Had nice graphs all the way through it. We've seen those kind of documents for 30 years, and it says, you're short of this product and this species of tree and so on. That's fine. They do that, but nothing is ever done about getting on the track of re-vigorizing that particular resource. You ask them later and they say, well, Congress didn't give us the funding. Well, Congress probably did give them the funding, but they just, there's no consequences in directing the money into some other resource that a corporation wants, and they sleep in bed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know, this might be a little digression, but I went out to the Union Agricultural Experiment Station earlier in the summer. And, of course, there are several scientists there, many of them with PhDs.
And I know most of them. We've often asked if to roll up our sleeves, we'll make an official appeal of a manager's decision to do this or do this, and then with a threat that we will bring the science to court and prove that they should abandon. And we are quite lucky to have a decision maker in a bureaucracy back away. But next year, they come right back with something very similar. So it's kind of a chase your tail.
Didn't you have a nickname? What was that nickname? I love that. The stamps.
5 cent Hughes I was noted for, because then just took a 5 cent stamp, went from 3 cents to 5 cents, and I appealed 40 timber sales with 1 5-cent stamp. So I have my conservation friend gave me a nickname of 5 cent Hughes.
Can you successfully appeal 40 timber sales?
All I did was look through the prospectus, and here were sales that were building from 50 to 70 miles of roads. Or in 1 year, that one prospectus would have, in 5 year period, that would cover that period of time, they would have built, they did build, a half of our Willow Whitman roads were built in them 5 years.
What was your affiliation? Did you appeal those on behalf of Isaac Walton League?
It was the Isaac Walton League, and they were the oldest and the most noted organization in 1922, and so this being 1950-60 era, they had quite a bit of clout. So you
were writing letters with these 5 cent stamps to federal agencies?
To the supervisors of the Region 6, aren't we, Colin?
Yeah.
For Washington and Oregon.
What did you say in these letters?
That they were not abiding by water quality. EPA had just come on at that time, and then we recognized just what is took those 40 years for salmon to get consideration on silt and water quality was so poor for salmon spawning that it started the ball rolling way back then when those were done.
So you were citing the regulations in these letters?
Uh-huh.
And
yeah, you have to do that.
Were you doing it in such a way as to make the agencies aware of these rules, or did you think they didn't know about them?
They knew about them, and really the media was pretty good to us. They gave us the local papers, and the Oregonian then gave pretty good publicity, and they felt it was somewhat damaging for a corporation so they tried.
But you must have been implicitly accusing them of trying to put something over on the public, of ignoring the regulations they knew existed and that they knew the corporations were violating. Isn't that what you were doing?
That's what I was doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My basement is as big as that room right there, and it's stacked clear full of boxes with all of those appeals and all those scientific studies that gave us some hope that we might be able to.
But you're saying your letters at least contributed to getting them to reconsider their actions?
Yeah.
Did a lot of other people write too, or were you a lone voice?
No. We had, I was president when the Minum back here was on the brink of Al Oman was then, was to become our, was it Ways and Means Chairman?
Sure.
And he did become and was for 15 years. Mm-hmm. The most powerful representative. He lived in Baker, and we threatened to vote him out of office if he didn't support Senator Hatfield's Minum River Protection Wilderness Bill. And the evening before the meeting came a telegram brought over from the Railroad Telegraph Office that said, Mr. Hughes, will you go to your Isaac Walton meeting, which was 150 people came, and that wasn't to our meeting, and all the Boise Cascade executives were all there. And when I read the telegram that said, not only you can tell all your membership that not only do I support Senator Hatfield's Minum bill, I have added all of the Little Minum, which was another 50,000 acres, to his bill. That was the greatest feeling that I ever had, and everybody got up and applauded, and Boise Cascade got up and walked out of the meeting. And it was a very elating thing. But Mr. Ullman was quite an outdoorsman. He had hiked and was familiar with all of the Minum and all the Little Minum. And so it was just actually being patient as you could be for a five-year period. We had hearings in Washington, D.C. We'd fly back to and come back and keep right on in Boise Cascade all the time working against us. But it was quite elating to have that telegram come and have that success story.
Would you say that you were an angry activist?
Very much so.
Did you have an angry tone in these letters?
That one was a threatening letter to Mr. Ullman of our meeting date and when we wanted an answer from him. We didn't really truthfully think it would work, but it did.
Mm-hmm. So at what point in your life did you become an angry activist?
From then on.
Well, not before.
No, that was an issue that had took many, many years to bring it to that stage.
Gradually rising anger?
Yeah. Yes. It hadn't been done anywhere else in the West. Yeah, because we had vast amount of roadless areas, only this one was so obvious where you just... Here's a highway, and you go down, and here's the Wallowa, and here's the Minum, 43 miles of the most pristine river in the world. And then you've already saw the mouth of the Grand Round River and the mouth of the Umatilla River, and it was no quality for fish and wildlife at all. So it was easy for... It was the perfect river to use for an example.
So far you haven't mentioned your direct connection with the Hell's Canyon area. Could we make that connection now?
We can do that. And actually, we had a three-state interest in the Hell's Canyon. And we had Senator Jordan... And then a new senator of Idaho, Len Jordan.
Yeah. He was governor too, wasn't he?
Governor, then senator. Mm-hmm. And then Bob Packwood was just elected, and he was a great outdoorsman, and he loved the Snake River floating, and went on many trips with us, and Rick hosted most of that, and we had our 25th anniversary for that legislation just last August. So it was kind of the same kind of a thing. Al Ullman was somewhat reluctant, but because of his experience with the mining, he supported legislation, and we all went to Washington, testified, and got the legislation finalized, and had no idea, and we kind of abandoned, because we had done our job. We gave it to a public agent that was to take care of it. Pretty soon we found they had built hundreds of miles of roads, logged everything that was loggable, and Rick worked for him as a fire fighter and right out on the NRA, and he just come around and rounded us all up and said, we've got to reorganize Hell's Canyon Preservation Council and get management that is going to do what they were supposed to do.
Well, I don't think I can fully understand this unless you take me farther back in time.
Okay.
Before there was a dam, was the land...
You're right.
Most of the land belonged to the federal government?
In the Oregon game synopsis, when you apply for hunting in the Hell's Canyon, it says 95% of the land is public. Mm-hmm. And it was almost that on both sides of the river, Idaho and Oregon.
Well, when it was designated public land, what were the limitations on its use or development? Were they specified in some way?
No, they could, the homesteaders out there, they like Chief Joseph's model for wintering. You went into the bottom of the canyons while during the winter, and then you went out to be out of the canyon the other. The white man did the same thing, but when the Depression came, they not only... they lost their, they lost what their ability to keep up the land and still live on it. So they came out to the communities out of those homesteads were all abandoned. And then that they diverted back to the public agency. So that picked up the percentage of they were given 40 or 60 acres for a homestead. And a lot of my relation were part of that.
Right. Explain that a little more. Could they claim homesteads anywhere they wanted to, or whether was there a portion of this large federal area that
wherever
was
they could, then I had an opinion that wherever they thought they could make a living, then they were...
And they just filed a claim.
And they
just
filed a claim. Uh-huh.
And there were no stipulations on how they were to use the land?
No, they were just... And they naturally, immediately abused the land by overgrazing it. Mm-hmm. And then they... And their stock could go to... the rest of the public land and virtually forage free vegetation.
And these were cattle?
Sheep. Mainly sheep and cattle.
I see. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I suppose the homesteaders thought that was the only way they could survive, make a living.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And nobody was telling them that there were any limits on what they could do, apparently.
No, they had... Forest Service would sometimes say you're apparently, obviously are abusing the range, and so we'll encourage you to build a trail to another bench where you can maybe still have as many livestock as you've got. And old homesteaders like Ace Barton, he wrote a book on this, on the Hell's Canyon, and one of the best that's ever been written, but he specifically recognized every homestead up and down the river, every little mile or 2 miles or 3 miles, and how many lived in that family, how many, how they were, the kids were assigned to drive the cattle every morning up to where they could get a graze, forage, and then the cows would come back and they'd milk them, take care of them to make, to, so the family would have something to live. But that was, he told all of those very interesting heart, you know, heartwarming experiences that they had to do to make a living.
What was the name of that book, do you remember?
Hell's Canyon, you know, below something. I think
would that have been early 20th century, 19th century?
Oh, yeah.
Or before then?
He's, I think, 97 now. He lives in over in Riggins, Idaho. Mm-hmm.
What's his name again?
Ace Barton.
A-C-E?
A-C-E, B-A-R-T-O-N. And he
was a homesteader.
His folks and grandparents, but he lived there most of his life, and that's why the book was so interesting, because it was so he had a real feel for nature. And of course what really you asked a while ago, it was building of as many as 7 dams were surveyed to be built in the canyon.
No, now when did that happen?
That was, Rick knows exactly, but that was kind of like building 28 miles of road at the Minon. It was also for Washington Power had asked for the license on the highest dam in the world. The one dam would back up over the top of 3 other dams above that dam, below the mouth of the Salmon River. And then 3 or 4 more dams were also proposed below there.
Now, that was after Grand Coulee, wasn't it?
Yes, Grand Coulee was being built in the 30s, along right after Bonneville Dam. Bonneville Dam, 1933, then then Coulee. Mm-hmm. Roosevelt, I think, inaugurated both of them.
So this plan for 7 dams might have been in the 50s? I think I remember reading about it at the time.
The proposals were in the 50s.
Yes, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And who was it? Was it the U.S. Corps of Engineers that was spearheading
that? They were private, mostly
private dams.
Private dams. Mm-hmm.
These were power companies.
Yes.
Washington Water Power.
That's
Idaho.
It.
Idaho.
You hit it. Yeah. I couldn't think of that. Washington Water Power.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I suppose they thought that this could be done and not damage anything.
That was,
or were they that naive, do you think?
Well, definitely. They were more than naive. But we already had built and licensed, you know, dozens of dams all over the Northwest, and it was an acceptable thing to do. No one questioned
cheap power,
of course. That was on it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what stopped that plan?
Packwood was the main instigator.
And what were his main motives, or what was his argument for stopping them?
Okay, Rick knows that for word, because he's repeated it many times.
Well, let me hear your version.
Well, what we really had was also another wonderful person. We had lots. We had lots of influential people. We just happened to have a William O. Douglas.
Yes.
That happened to be only this Chief Justice. Mm-hmm. He graduated from Whitman College over here,
yep.
And he loved our mining and our Eagle Cap Wilderness,
yep.
And he just lived there.
I met him one day when he was living
did
there.
You really?
Yes, I did. Yep.
He would go up the Lost Keen and be over on the mining, and so we found that there was a loophole in the not who was going to build the dam, but what, Rick?
But whether there would be one at all.
That's it. That's, I told you he'd do that.
That's important. Yes.
Or wouldn't do it at all.
Yeah.
And so, by golly, we went after that, and when it came before Chief Old Douglas, he just said, hey, there isn't anybody going to build a dam.
How did it get to him? Who appealed it to the Supreme Court?
Conservationists.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And Packwood supported it, and he had, and we had encouraged lots and lots of other senators mm-hmm. to support mm-hmm. And recognize the canyon for what it was.
Now, exactly where were you and what were you doing at that time?
Well, you know, there was such a good representative, conservationist representatives from Washington, from Idaho, and from Oregon, that when we had another building on, just like this one, it's a 9-story building, we had another 9-story hotel,
yep.
And there was a big, big ballroom, mm-hmm. and in that ballroom, we had like 250 people there for the hearing. And it was just overwhelming. And when I came to Le Grand in 1950 to be a jeweler, all this issue was brewing, and I'd go to my Chamber of Commerce that I had just joined because I was a new businessman in town, and the whole group of 50 businessmen was how many sacks of cement, how many railroad loads of lumber was going to go through Le Grand to Wallowa County down to the Hells or down to the High Mountain Sheep Dam side to build the highest dam in the world. And everybody's pockets was just running over with dollars.
And their palms were itchy.
And I never will forget, and my brother-in-law, head of the Game Commission, he wasn't my brother-in-law at that time, but when Senator Packwood came and listened to their enthusiasm for and wanted his support for building the dam, that when the meeting finished, when he stood up, he only just said, there never will be a dam like that built in Hell's Canyon. You could hear a pin drop 3 blocks away. And they all got up and never said a word, and all 50 of them walked out. And only my brother-in-law and I were the only ones that were there to shake Bob Packwood's hand. They had never even dreamed that a senator dare say there never will be a dam built in that canyon.
So at that meeting, you said there were 250 people?
100.
150. Well, who got up and spoke in opposition?
Excuse me, I got my ballroom meeting up on in the main mezzanine mixed up. This was in the restaurant downstairs, 50 people. That was about all the businessmen that were in town. And they were there because they expected Packwood to say, yes, you can build your dam. But he didn't.
Well, the meeting in the restaurant was not the same as the congressional hearing?
No, okay. That's right.
But at the congressional hearing, were there people who were in opposition to the dam speaking?
Oh, yeah. We had lots of... Mm-hmm. It was kind of a balanced program, really. Okay. Because all of the county judges in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, as well as... and then we were fortunate then to have another neat guy, and that was Tom McCall, Governor Tom McCall, the greatest conservation Republican that we ever knew.
Do you remember at all specifically what the people who were opposed to the dam used as their arguments?
Well, it meant the tribal people shouldn't be forgotten. We were going to cover up all of their historical tribal heritage, a lot of their ancestral burial grounds were all going to be underwater, and which we'd already done on the Columbia River.
Yep.
So we had, of course, the power company people. There were hundreds of them because every one of them that had planned on being stockholders and building more power dams, they were all represented at these meetings.
Well, I'm just curious to know what other arguments there could be stated against the dams, the ancestral burial grounds. What other considerations?
I don't seem to be very good at remembering all those particulars. Of course, the recreational part was brought out over and over because it was kind of in its infancy, but everybody seemed to have a very good grasp on just what was to happen and now has happened, that they have to apply for a permit to get on the river. The demand is so high, maybe only every other year or every 2 years you had to get maybe a 5-day permit.
Right.
And so that was one of our biggest factors.
Building one dam, though, has increased the recreational opportunities, hasn't it?
Well, not really. I can't think of any time that it has.
I don't know the usual level of water flow, but I thought a dam that would back up more water would give more opportunities for jet boats and that sort of thing.
We built, after we stopped the
seven
that
dams.
Part of the federal dams,
yeah.
Then of course four dams that are below Lewiston to the Columbia River were built.
Yeah.
And there's really hardly any recreational, just water skiing and fishing isn't nearly as good. All the good fishing is beyond them on the clear water and the Salmon River, the free-flowing rivers provide
better fishing.
Better fishing.
Yeah. I'm still trying to visualize, though, what could be said in a hearing like that that would justify Packwood saying there will never be a dam built there. What could he have said that would persuade anybody that that's the way it should be left?
Isn't that amazing that I that was almost 45 years ago.
Yeah. Do you want to take a break and think about that a little more?
Well, not sure that this old boy can remember how he, because I think he even surprised us when he made that rashest statement.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know that I recorded in my mind how he came to that conclusion.
I wonder.
We'd ask him to do that, but there was no indication until he made that announcement before two conservationists and 50 businessmen.
Could it have been just strong emotion? Would that have carried it?
No, he could do that. He does have that characteristic. Yes, he does. Mm-hmm. If he could do it on that, but I think if he, and he obviously was nailed by Chamber of Commerce people for how he made it, and I'm sure he had it. I wish I remembered what he come back with.
Yeah. Well, maybe he'll come back to
his stand.
Maybe he'll come back to you, because I think that is an interesting point.
It is, definitely, because that was about as an alarming statement that not very many politicians would dare make.
I should think he would have feared being run out of town on a rail.
You know, the same as we're threatened to do with Al Almond.
Yes.
No, that's right.
Right.
But he never did waver.
Uh-huh.
And he'd come back and celebrated the 25th anniversary with us. Bob Packwood came back and of course enjoyed seeing us old friends and us seeing him too.
Do you remember your feelings at the time that the decision was made not to build the dam? Were you amazed or exhilarated or?
I think I almost went out in the middle of Adams Avenue and yelled.
Celebrate.
it was pretty exciting.
Yeah.
And then the court cases and the legislation went before the Chamber of Commerce people, made sure.